Welcome to Cross Defense. I'm your host, Pastor Rod Zwanisser, welcoming you into this unique program where we talk about apologetics. You know, a lot of people out there tell me, I don't know what that is, but they ought to if they're a Christian, because the great apostle Peter, he admonishes all of us to be ready to make an apologetic. Apology is the Greek word, and translated normally into defense, that's where we got the name for this show, Cross Defense. So it's for people of all ages who have intellectual questions, intellectual concerns, and there are a lot of them to talk about. Today, we're going to talk about some objections to apologetics. Our guest is Dr. Jeff Mallinson. He's a professor of theology and philosophy at Concordia University, Irvine, California. Welcome back to Cross Defense, Jeff.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm always glad to join in on this great conversation you got going.
I don't know if you're aware of this at all, but more and more people are listening in around the world, and even people that like apologetics that aren't Lutherans are tuning in. And now I put it on some websites, some blogs, and people are liking it. So this is neat. Jeff is not only a professor there at Concordia, Irvine, California, he's also a thinking fellow of 1517, the Legacy Project. You can find them at 1517legacy.com. And you'll see his photo right there. You can click on it, see not only this series that Jeff has written for us, but a bunch of others. This series is called What's Wrong with Apologetics. We did an hour, I believe, back in August, and you can find that on our archives. We're talking about a charge against apologetics that it's anti-intellectual. Jeff, start us off on this. What are we talking about with this critique of apologetics?
Yeah, well, it can go both ways. In one sense, people would say the way some folks do apologetics is anti-intellectual, that it plays fast and loose with science, or it doesn't take into account all the evidence. But where I was really going with it in this last post was that some people are themselves, some Christians especially, are anti-intellectual, and therefore they resist or resent anyone trying to do apologetic work. That is, faith, they've kind of bought this idea that's after the Enlightenment, that faith is something that is private, it is something that is based on emotion and sentiment, it's a heart thing. And anytime you try to bring in evidence or arguments, well, you're using your brain, you're using your head, and faith surely is a different sort of thing. We'll leave the brain, we'll leave intellectual issues to the scientist, but we are very happy to have a relatively unreflective faith that is based in a rather simplistic way on desire. I want to believe, and so I do, and this is my religion, and so, you know, you can have yours. And so it's a strange thing, especially amongst many conservative Christians who would say, no, these other religions are false and my religion is true, but yet they operate as if they're pluralists, as if all of these things are true for the individuals who hold them. And I think this is an unfortunate thing. I'm trying to understand why people go this way. And I think we talked about last time, there are good theological reasons, or at least good theological intentions, why people would resist apologetics. One reason being the idea that the Holy Spirit is the one that enlivens us, that we cannot rescue ourselves neither through our good works nor through our good research and study. But if you go to the history of the church, it's not that it's always been some kind of philosophical argument. Sometimes apologetics takes forms that relate to art, or, yes, to science, sometimes to history, sometimes to literature. And so if we open up our definition of what apologetics is, we realize that it really is about the whole human experience and really asking, what are we doing here? What do we owe each other? And is there a God? And what do we make of this? How do we find him? And we can find this through a variety of different investigations.
Okay, so you said that this kind of goes both ways, and I see that, where they can say it's too intellectual for Christianity, we don't need it, we don't want it. You know, I don't know if Kierkegaard was the first one to ever talk like this, but it seems like a lot of people are there with him. You know, he called that the leap of faith, I think even a blind leap of faith, you know, that the Bible says it, so I believe it. We hear a lot of that. And the other side of that coin, you're saying, is those that say, it's not really intellectual enough for where I'm coming from. So we have to talk about both of that sides of intellectual. And I would say, boy, apologetics really tries to do that. It's hard to ferret out sometimes quickly, we should say, with the person you're talking to, where they're coming from. But you know, I know the Lord has blessed our church, the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, with some real intellectual people. I would include you in that, Jeff. And so you can get as deep and as academic and scholarly as you want to go, and you can keep it, more on the other side too.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of ways to go on this. I'm one too that I'm not that schooled in philosophy. When people start throwing that jargon around and that, I'm kind of one that gets kind of, I'm not sure I want to get into this much. But I guess the better way to go on this, and which I've learned to do, is start asking questions. Hey, what do you mean by that word? What do you mean by that phrase? Maybe read that years ago, don't remember quite what you're saying, and take that. Around young people that you're especially with these days, Jeff, are the majority of them on either side of this intellectual, divide about apologetics? Too intellectual or not intellectual enough?
Yeah, this is the conundrum. I mean, really, the conversations I have with my colleagues and my own experience over the last 15 years of teaching has really posed a real problem here for me, and that is that it's neither in a way. The freshman students, the 19-year-olds, the 18-year-olds, it's not as if they're coming at their questions of faith or their beliefs with incredibly intelligent arguments, nor are they resistant and fideistic or, resistant to apologetics. It's apathy. They don't seem to think that it matters. They don't care whether they're from a church background, and they say, well, yeah, my parents were Lutheran. When I ask them, where they identify, or my parents, I was Catholic, they never have a present concern. And even with, I think this week I taught four 80-person sections of freshmen, guest lectured on there on a similar topic. I was working with Veith's book on vocation and ethics, and then in three classes for freshman theology. In each of those cases, I really tried to rile them up. For instance, I asked them if they had read this particular section, and when I sensed that they really hadn't deeply engaged it, that is, they didn't have any negative criticisms, I told them all they would make really great cult followers. And even that didn't infuriate them.
Wow.
I almost wanted more angry atheists or, strong, charismatic Christians that resisted my sense of sola scriptura. I didn't have any of that.
Huh.
I had a lack of interest. And yet, I still believe that these interests, the things that really matter about Christian theology, do matter to these students. But for some reason, they don't see the connection between what we're reading in either scripture or introduction to theological, ideas, textbook. They're for some reason not seeing that these are life and death issues or issues that relate to them in any concrete way. Mm. They've grown up their whole lives really just going from band practice to soccer to math tutoring to whatever. And so they always just see what's immediately in front of them. And if we're talking about the big questions of life or, what happens after death, these questions are so far removed, they've got to deal with where they're going to go for soccer practice, and so they just don't seem as interested. And so that's been the thing, I think, that I'm most interested in trying to crack, or to solve. What is it that makes the apologetic question not antagonistic or exciting, but just irrelevant to them?
Yeah, and that's a big word that we hear bandied about, not just by the younger generations, but by some of the middle and older ones too, is they don't see these age-old questions that you and I, would thrive on and look at the history of thought on that as being really relevant. They just don't see any relevance in this.
Mm-hmm.
So you're on to something there. One of the things that struck me when we're talking about the relevance of these issues. Is God to them and Jesus and all of that, is it, important in maybe their development as a human being and more importantly as a person, that's been kind of in their background? And now as you were describing it, so much of their life is consumed by still finding out who this person is that's me and what am I made up? What have I like? What friends are really good for me? All of those things. And somehow we gotta interrupt that kind of conversation and say, hello, there's a big universe out here with a lot of history and a lot of time that can help you on all of this.
Well, I don't want to be so bleak on your show, but right now I'm feeling pretty bleak about it because it's not. I mean, I almost wish that was the way they expressed it. That is, the way you said it was, what's good for me? What kind of friends should I have? Those immediate questions. They're not even asking those questions. They're looking for immediate gratification. And honestly, from some of the chatter, that I see and hear as I'm just walking across campus, it's not how can I have a fulfilling married relationship. It's how can I hook up this weekend. It's not what's good for me in terms of deep friendships. It's does this crowd like my outfit? And I know these are problems for late adolescents across the board. But at least in my current anecdotal Southern California experience is they're not even taking themselves seriously. So in the last big class session that I had, I'm an easygoing guy. They know I'm a relaxed kind of prof. I'm not a hellfire and brimstone guy, but I started tirading against them and I said, "You students, it's not that you're naughty. It's that you're nihilistic. You've got no meaning and your sin isn't even interesting. It's desperate. It's not you've lost eros." And you have immediate gratification, and you've degraded yourselves in a way that isn't making me look down on you as being villains. It's making me feel so much pity for you. And this is not something I would have ever expected to hear me say. When I was a young man growing up in high school, I always thought, when the pastor or a theology professor would say something related to sexual integrity or personal integrity, I thought they were just, usually being a little bit moralistic. And I've come to see this as this deeply tragic aspect of their condition. And I think it's particular. In some ways, it's the human story. But right now, there's a loss of meaning that is so great that those questions about friendship and even erotic love are so vacuous, they're so empty for them, that the question of God, I mean, that's so far down the horizon, they can't even see it.
My goodness. And so, what comes to my mind is some of those biblical passages, like the Apostle Paul writes that they have become so downgraded that the only interest they have is in self-pleasure, self-indulgence. Mm-hmm. That's Luther's classic definition of sin, is the individual focused on himself. And so kind of oblivious to everything outside. You're a much younger man than I am, Jeff, and so this kind of startles me that you're facing this bleakness that I know in my older age and years as a pastor, I'd get frustrated with the young people, and I saw them gradually degrading over generations. Mm-hmm. And it just was hard to stimulate them other than try to bring them to grips that this is a life and death issue for them. Mm-hmm. And I would tell them, I would get in their face and say, hey, if I'm doing this right, and I think I am, it's as good as Jesus here speaking to you. Does that mean anything to you? And that'd start to get their attention, but it would not get it at all as it would when I was growing up. If a mm-hmm. pastor would say that to me, I would have been, oh my goodness, I would have been death struck. It's hard to rankle them, it sounds like, in any meaningful conversation other than, the downward spiraled life that the world that they live in. And I know from being around my grandchildren, my goodness, that it's there in spades. Is this a chronic across the board with the students? I'm not sure what your student population looks out there, Jeff. Are most of your kids come from pretty affluent families and places?
You know, there's a good deal of that, and I think that probably skews my perception of things. But I've taught at 4 universities now, and the trend, you know, if I were to chart this on a graph for financial folks, it seems consistent. So it is clear to me that I've almost in the last 2 years seen an exponential spike, but it would be an anticipated exponential spike. That is, I saw this kind of coming over the last 4 years, but the seniors of today even recognize it in the freshmen of today. There's some emptiness that has arrived. And I don't want to beat a dead horse on this, and I know it always feels this way, and I don't want to be like, you know, the guy saying this is the age that's worse than any other age. I'm not saying it's worse than any other age. I'm just saying something unique is happening, and that is if you go back to a pastor who was frustrated with the hippie kids in the 60s, say, in his congregation, he might see young people who were trying to find God through LSD, right? They wanted to open up the fire hose, and immediately, that is not through Christ, not through Scripture, immediately experience God, and it could be horrific. But it was still a spiritual quest, at least for some, or for people that were interested in free love or the adventure of living in nature and, you know, painting yourself and walking around naked. There was still a spirituality behind it, or at least a parody of spirituality. And so what I'm trying to argue isn't that they're necessarily more sinful. It's just that they're more uninterested in the meaning behind any of it. They're not sinning because they reject their parents' values. They have no values at all, or they certainly don't have any values in the traditional sense of the things that they would care about in terms of their own character and virtues. Not because they're necessarily bad, but they don't see any reason to be virtuous because there's no reason to do anything. Mm-hmm. And it's so subtle that it's kind of underlying what they do. And in terms of the student population we have here, we've got Christian students, we've got, you know, nominally Christian students, and some, you know, they're seekers or they're, you know, not interested at all. It doesn't matter. Across the board, I see a similar lack of that kind of theoretical interest in where they're going and what they're doing. They're not as panicked as I think they should be facing a strange economy and a fragmenting global set of crises, Ebola and ISIS and all this. And I think they might be on overload. Maybe they're just saying, hey, look, there's all this stuff going on. Let's just have fun, play video games before it's over.
Yeah, you only go around once, so mm-hmm. might as well just let it all hang out there and do what feels good to us. So it's kind of striking to me, not being around this much anymore, Jeff, that am I correct in hearing that they're not into all finding and exploring a meaning to life or a purpose in life yet, that's not even on their intellectual and emotional radar at this point?
Yeah, I'm sure there's a few great students that do, but by and large, it's a minority.
Wow. You know, in your article about anti-intellectualism, you kind of break out and then say that there are some life-changing events sometimes that do shake a person from being, you know, irrelevant in matters of theology and eternity. And I'm thinking, you know, some of these young people have to have already experienced death situations mm-hmm. in their life. I can remember I was 13 and my first grandparent passed away. And that struck me. I still can remember the day going to the mortuary and, you know, standing around the casket of my grandmother. And especially when my mom says, "Do you want to kiss grandma goodbye?" And I'm like, "Are you kidding me?" This was really gross to me. I'd never seen a corpse before, and I started thinking about it. And you know, when you're 13 and think you're cool, you don't tell a lot of adults what's going on inside. But later on, I sure did, and I wanted some, you know, to talk about that. You know, what was that all about? I mean, You step on a fly, and that's nothing to me. But boy, Grandma lying there looking so bad. I mean, everybody said she looked great. She looked terrible to me. Is this at all a scenario in their life when it comes up that has any true impact on them?
Yes. And I think that's a real charitable way of thinking about this, you know, Rod. The students who say, you know, or they seem cynical or they seem indifferent, there's always a chance, and I think it comes up on several occasions, where they're putting on a facade. The world is so overwhelming, they think there probably is no meaning, they've been let down by their parents, they've been let down by their school system, whatever it is. And so for them to really get all fired up about theology or apologetics, say, would put them in a vulnerable spot. But you're right, at certain moments, there are things that wake them up and they trigger an intellectual need. And it's not intellectual for the sake of learning or for the sake of just talking about theories. It's intellectual because the mind has to solve a problem, and in this case, it's life and death. I don't throw out these days many, the kids call props. I don't give a lot of quotations from John Calvin anymore these days. But Calvin has a nice line somewhere in his Institutes, and he says, "We're all great philosophers for 15 minutes after we see a dead body walk or a corpse go by in a funeral procession. For 15 minutes, we truly reflect on God and our sinful condition and our need for Christ, and then we go back to business trying to figure out how we can hustle, you know, the best deal for wheat or something, you know." And I think Calvin is spot on there. But where does he get this? He gets this from Martin Luther, this idea of law and gospel working together to bring people to a clarity. And really, apologetics, this takes us back to apologetics. Apologetics needs to focus on the role, or its role, in many ways, as law. Apologetics sets one up to hear an ordained a servant of God through word and sacrament delivering the good news. Apologetics doesn't bring the good news as much as it provides the setup to say, here are the conditions, here's what we need, but then the promise given for the individual, passed on, that's not something I do sitting around a table in a classroom. It's something that I direct students to in the context of the church, in the context of the means of grace. But without understanding why they need the means of grace, the medicine, I think that's where we're losing young people, just numerically within the congregations, but we're also losing them intellectually. So think about it, the things that I mentioned three areas where people get really interested in intellectual matters. They wise up. The first is death, right? So if you've got a terminal illness, all of a sudden you bone up on medicine and you start to use multiple syllable words and you start to know what a biopsy is and you start to know the different types of cancer. And so why do you do this? Because you've got a need to resist death. But the others are interesting too. I think I mentioned drugs. So young people who aren't very good in biology or they're not good in chemistry who learn how to be biologists and chemists so they can make drugs. What are they looking for? They're looking for fulfillment and some kind of fulfilling of what St. Augustine called that God-shaped vacuum. Now, of course, we know drugs can't do that, but they are itching for the medicine.
They
and then
sure
the third
are.
Area let, I find most common.
You're saying there,
you're laughing because you're probably thinking of people actually itching, the invisible spiders off their skin.
I'm running out of time. Let's take our first break. And
okay.
When we come back, we'll look for the third scenario that kind of gives us a chance for the gospel of Jesus Christ. Stick with us. You're listening to Cross Defense here on Worldwide KFUO.
Worldwide KFUO Radio salutes our day sponsor on this Monday, October 20th, 2014. Today's day sponsor is Matthew Klaus. Today's day sponsor has made a contribution to Worldwide KFUO Radio in remembrance of his baptism. Once again, we say thank you to Matthew Klaus of Baldwin, Missouri, today's worldwide KFUO Day sponsor.
The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, on behalf of Concordia Plan Services, Lutheran Church Extension Fund, the LCMS Foundation, Lutheran Housing Support Corporation, Concordia University System, and Corporate Synod, daily reaches out to our members and partners, working together to support our local, global, and international ministries, church workers, and LCMS initiatives at large to carry the mission forward and to serve each other in love. Opportunities to serve, lcms.org/jobsboard.
Have you ever missed a live broadcast of one of your favorite KFUO programs? Well, let me propose a convenient solution for you. Visit the KFUO website, kfuo.org, and download your favorite program by way of podcast to your iPhone or other smart device. It's easy, it's simple, it's convenient, and you'll never miss another program. KFUO, the official voice of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, is the messenger of good news by way of radio, web, and podcast.
In 1939, Lutherans started resettling people displaced by World War II. In 1960, we asked, who else can we help, and opened our service networks to refugees and migrants. As wars and conflicts create the need for asylum and refuge, Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service is still asking, who else can we help? Today, with partners, congregations, and volunteers, we're resettling refugees, reuniting families, and rekindling dreams. You can help. LIRS.org/volunteer.
What does faithful family life look like in a Lutheran worldview? Hi, I'm Eddie Bates, host of Faith and Family. Each day, we discuss different aspects of faithful family life with experts and everyday people. We discuss parenting, aging, work, school, relationships, vocation, and more. Join me weekdays at 10 a.m. for Faith and Family on Worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news, underwritten by Concordia University, Wisconsin.
Hello, I'm Rod Zwanitzer, Director of Broadcast for KFUO. We totally depend on the gracious supporters who want this gospel voice to continue and expand as the messenger of good news of Christ. A wonderful part of this support is our underwriters, an ever-increasing number, and so we ask you to find out who they are by checking them out on our website or as you hear them here on KFUO. Write, call, or tell them how much you appreciate their support of Worldwide KFUO.
You've discovered Worldwide KFUO, a radio station where you can find the clear biblical understanding of Christianity proclaimed daily in both word and song. Our talk programs can be heard live or on demand at your convenience anytime worldwide. The KFUO talk programs proclaim the true Word of God, focused on salvation through Christ and Scripture alone. You've discovered KFUO.org, the messenger of good news.
Hi, trial lawyer and apologist Craig Parton inviting you to listen to Cross Defense the first Monday of every month to what we're calling Apologetics Boot Camp 101. You'll hear me pose hard-hitting questions to the foremost living defender of the Christian faith, John Warwick Montgomery, on such issues as God's existence, the problem of evil, and more. You'll also be able to participate with your questions and comments. Join us on Cross Defense the first Monday of every month, Apologetics Boot Camp 101.
Welcome back to Cross Defense. Rod Zwanitzer, your host, hanging out with Dr. Jeff Mallinson. He's written a series on what's wrong with apologetics. You can find that on 1517, thelegacyproject.com, or we'll have a link to where you can see all these essays and more by Dr. Mallinson on our website, kfuo.org, Cross Defense, and then you'll see all of these, and you can link right up to it. Jeff, when we left, you were talking about three times where people are kind of snapped out of their view of, you know, hostility and apologetics is irrelevant to me, when there's life and death situations, you know, welcome to the world through modern chemistry as you were taking us on. Mm-hmm. And then the third one we've yet to hear, so I'll let you introduce the third scenario.
Yeah, it's not as exciting as drugs or death, I suppose, but it's financial planning. And folks who get a little bit uninterested in intellectual matters all of a sudden want to find the smartest lady or gentleman who knows everything about the world of finance and investment and stocks and equities, and they know the ins and the outs, and they don't want a simple Sunday school answer when it comes to their millions of dollars if they're going to invest it, right?
Absolutely.
And that's right, because what are they looking for? I think in all of these areas, you've got medical issues, you're facing life and death. With drugs, you're looking for fulfillment. With financial planning, you want peace and security. These are three things that people seek in their concrete existence and their daily lives, but they're also the things that religion, in this case Christianity, is the fulfillment of or provides. So you can get the best doctor, you're still going to die. You can maybe find some euphoria in heroin or something, but it's going to be very short-lived, and it's going to eventually take you down into a living hell. You can store up all your treasures here on heaven, where moth and rust destroy, as Scripture says, but eventually you're going to have your descendants inherit it, and they'll squander it, most likely. And so those are three real desires for health, for fulfillment, and peace, but they're also things that are not able to be fully achieved in the ways that they are. So my case is simply, if you're going to give attention to medical issues and fulfillment and financial planning, what about the full fulfillment of all these things in Christianity? At least it deserves the same intellectual lifting at times that these others do. And when we recognize that, then that takes me to the thing that I think is most important for our work with late adolescents. And it's something that's been very important to me in conversation with my colleague, Mark Brighton. Mark Brighton has been here for quite some time as a New Testament prof here at Concordia, and he confirms with me that the students are different than they were before. And maybe 10 years ago, if you came and you brought the pure, unadulterated gospel to young evangelical students here, say, in Irvine, we've certainly had a lot of those kind of students come through because of the Jesus People movement and the Calvary Chapel and the Saddleback, all the mega churches. I mean, this is, in Southern California, you know, ground zero for a certain 20th century evangelicalism. And in that, as expressed by this rapture culture, the fear of not being taken up in the rapture, a deep anxiety, because they don't just need, in 15 years ago, they don't just need to believe in Jesus. They don't just need to be baptized and hear the promise and believe. It's that they have to deep down really be sorry for their sin. And if they're not sorry enough, they might not be raptured. Or if they don't believe enough, or if they don't cry enough at their altar call, say, then they might not be taken up. And so that anxiety led to a response, that feeling of desperation before the law led to a response for Concordia profs in particular to come and bring the heritage of the Reformation, to bring justification by grace alone, through faith alone, on account of Christ alone, and people saw it as water in the desert. It was an oasis.
Mm.
But today, can't do it that way. I can't just show up and bring the pure, unadulterated gospel and think anybody's going to care. So what changed? I contend that what changed is that we got good at interpreting or translating the gospel for a new generation. We got good at putting it into words they might understand. We got good at emphasizing it. We got good at proclaiming it. We put it in song. But we never translated properly the law, because the law to these kids sounds like nagging from the 19th century. It doesn't apply. No more than we would be concerned about the Christians in the 1920s who were all about temperance and prohibition. We'd say, oh, that was silly. That's how the kids today view most of the moral or law-oriented stuff that comes forward or comes out of the mouth of pastors and other Christians.
So it's out of the past, which they're thinking doesn't relate to my world at all, my situation.
Right. Yeah, and so with Brighton and I have been just, you know, when we're sitting around at lunch, just brainstorming what are the ways that we could re-engage the students so that they would understand the value of what we're talking about. Even if they don't buy it, at least pay attention for a little bit longer before they dismiss it. And for me, it all really revolves around popular culture and finding ways to connect with young people to show them not only that there is judgment, but they themselves recognize that they're experiencing judgment. That the world that they're in some cases a living hell. It's a weeping and a gnashing of teeth. It's darkness. When I can connect properly, things start to come alive. But that's the trick. And for me, the most effective thing over the last couple years, when talking with students casually or in class, is to address the issue of zombies. And I know some listeners are going to say, what are you talking about? but the genre of zombie apocalypse, as I'm sure most people recognize, has really really come to the surface. It's almost overplayed now. But just this last, I think Monday, I believe, unless it was on Sunday, The Walking Dead, and I've been watching them, though I didn't watch it this last season, The Walking Dead was one of the highest rated premieres, at least for a long time. So what is it about the zombie genre that is so compelling to young and old alike? And I think it is that the zombie apocalypse as a genre helps to do what maybe the Lord of the Flies, you know, did for a previous generation, to identify and resonate with a real concern. And the concerns of the zombie genre, I think, can help us illustrate what's going on with young people, but also be a place for, you know, some kind of common ground or common conversation. So do you mind if I just tell you a few things I've noticed about that?
Absolutely.
All right. So the first thing is, if you look at the late adolescents, most of them are dealing with a world of fragmentation. Parents are divorced, or they live in a community one year and then they move to another part of the country. There isn't that kind of stability. And the zombie apocalypse helps to connect them, or helps to reflect that sense of wandering. They're pilgrims, they're nomads, they're no longer tied to a small Midwestern town. Now, certainly if someone's listening in a small Midwestern town, this might not apply, but kids in the cities, in these urban areas that are growing, as the demographic is shifting out of the Midwest and going to these urban centers, these young people feel disconnected and unmoored, if that makes sense.
Wow. And you know, any theologian that listens to this, and I'm certainly one that's not up on zombies, but, mm-hmm. you know, I am aware of this as The Walking Dead, those that are you know, dead but are still nagging the rest of humanity. I can see the ties with mm-hmm. with preaching the law. I mean, you know, it's one of the most powerful things, I think, that the Bible has to say, like in Ephesians, that, you know, in our normal state of original sin, we are spiritually dead. Right. And so I can see the ties for this. So is that a way to connect with the zombie generation that's growing up, Jeff? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. I mean, if you're working with a high school group, say, at your church, and you start out a conversation by saying, I noticed that zombies are big these days. What is it about zombies or the zombie genre that resembles your experience? And they start doing it themselves. You know, so I said this the other day, and a student, young lady, said, "Listen, we're just wandering through life. We're zombies. We're corpses. We don't have purpose. We don't have meaning." This was a non-believing student, right? So when I'm talking about law and gospel and the Old Testament, her eyes are glazed over, to be frank. Mm-hmm. When I asked her, "What is it about zombies that reflects how you experience life?" She snapped right into it, and she said, "Listen, we are like this. We are just going through the motions of life without any purpose. We are insatiably hungry, and we're amoral or immoral, right?" And so then I could say to them, "Maybe I didn't say it right. Maybe you thought I was saying, if you don't believe, you're going to go to hell. So naughty you for not believing. What I'm saying to you is, you're in a living hell right now, and you know it. Don't lie to yourself. Don't lie to me." And they said, "Right. Okay. Yes, Dr. Mallinson, that's right." And one of the unique things about that particular version of the zombie story, the zombie myth, The Walking Dead, the whole turn in the series and in the graphic novels that is unique to them, to that series, is that the Walking Dead, that phrase, Walking Dead, turns out not to refer to the zombies. The Walking Dead refers to the human beings during the zombie apocalypse. In the case of the Walking Dead series, it's because what they find is you don't get bitten, and this is, I think, very theologically accurate. Everybody always thinks the zombie bites you, and then that infects you. So the sinner infects you, and then you become a zombie. So the moral of the story is stay away from those who drink, smoke, and chew, and don't go with girls and guys that do, or whatever the old phrase was, right?
Sure.
So that the idea was sin was outside of you. Sin was these other bad people. So stay away from them, and you'll be safe. And so the church withdrew, and it got into its own walls. But the story of the zombie apocalypse in The Walking Dead is that you already have the virus. So that the moment you die, and could be from natural causes in the series that's on TV, you will become a zombie immediately after death. You are already dead. And this is has been, to me, the most important way of kind of translating over the nature of sin. It's inside you already, and it comes to the surface in these other moments. And that not only are you empty, but you really have this sickness, and we need to get you the medicine.
Wow. What about then, going for broke about the one who emptied himself and became nothing on mm-hmm. behalf of us walking dead zombies spiritually? Can you go there, or you have to be careful when you go back to the gospel, Jeff?
Yeah, well, what's really interesting in the graphic novel related to The Walking Dead, there's a scene in there where they're starting to read from 1 Corinthians 13, and it seems so absurd, but in the graphic novel, it is absurd because they're talking about all these things that you can't do. Love others, not be selfish. Well, in the zombie apocalypse, you're supposed to be selfish, and you don't let somebody in to the gate because they might be a cannibal or infected or something like this. In other words, if you experience the world in the zombie apocalypse, it is not something you can fix. Because as much as you would love to help everybody around you, you kind of have to be selfish and violent and tough. And that's what we say today. You know, we think, I don't want to be greedy, but that's the dog-eat-dog world we live in. Into this, and it's in the books, it really is, they see this sense that Jesus is the one who then takes the risk, right? The risk to approach the walking dead. And in so doing, he is consumed or destroyed by them, right? But then defeats death. Now, I don't want to go too deep into it to say that that could be the new, the new allegory. It's not like that. It's that if, in fact, you were worried about zombies outside your door, and then there are also good people and kids and whatever, you would become less of the Christian that you are today, or you might be tempted to be, right? And less self-sacrificing. This happened in the Middle Ages when priests abandoned their posts, their vocations, because they didn't want to get infected, right? Sure. What would happen if we have an Ebola outbreak today? Are pastors going to be consoling the dying, or are they going to take care of their own families and flee? That's a tough and real decision. And in this case, Jesus then serves to say, I am going to be the one that will be consumed. And in being consumed, I will bring from death to life this precarious situation we're in. And obviously, we're not really worried about real zombies, but we're reflecting on the government that's failed us. In the zombie genre, the government is the one that usually creates the virus that causes all this mess in the first place. The pastors are often becoming thugs. The cops become villains. Ex-convicts find heroism. So everything kind of gets overturned. And I like to take students to the theology of the cross and say that's what Christianity is about. It's throwing this whole thing on its head in Christ.
Oh, boy, that's certainly true. I mean, the scriptural proof about the apostles going out and literally turning the world upside down on its head about its mm-hmm. view. I like where you're going with this, Jeff, because if the individual does not understand their condition, their relationship with God from their conceived state as being begotten by a couple of sinners, there's no chance at all the gospel is going to do its thing because, as you said so correctly before. It's law and gospel, and these kids have had a lot of the nice stuff thrown at them, and mm-hmm. they sounds like they really didn't understand the problem.
Right.
Heard the solution so much, I don't know what the solution is about. I'm walking around in this world, and I'm not sure where I'm at. And wow, that's not a Christian place to be.
No.
So this zombie culture really aids you and hopefully the rest of us in our talks with these young people to bring this in that you know we are the walking dead as original sinners. It might as well be over. You know, I preached chapel today and I talked about how, you know, Isaiah gets in the presence of God and he says, it's all over. Woe is me because I'm a guy with unclean lips and I live among a people that are unclean lips. Oh, my goodness. The zombie culture is beyond me, all wrapped up in myself and the rest of us, they're into ourself. And something from the outside comes in and takes care of a sin issue.
And I think contrary to what some of the mega churches had thought, that talking about sin or a sense of condemnation would be a turnoff, I find that calling the thing what it is, to use Luther's words, is actually very rewarding. Our students get a almost a sense of relief. If I say, things are out of whack for you and you know it, they say, yeah, things are out of whack for me. Thank you for finally being honest. It's not being more moralistic, and I want to be very clear to the listener. I'm not saying preach the law more or preach the gospel less, by no means. I'm saying preach the law better, translate better, be more attuned to the questions that young people and non-believers in general are actually asking, and try to find a way to be more artful as we consider the way we preach or, in the terms of, say, art, the way we communicate law.
Yeah, I like the way you're phrasing that. Letting the law bring them to a state of repentance and confession is where it's at. I think mm-hmm. what you're saying. Am I close there,
oh,
Jeff?
Yeah. It's like in Alcoholics Anonymous. You don't have to be a downer all the time. You know, if somebody shows up to AA and they say, I'm only assuming here, but I would assume that no one's going to get on your case for having had a drink that week. They're going to say, of course, that's why you're here, right? So it's a safe place to sense your condemnation. Because it's not so much that the church is mad at you, or you're, in the case of AA, that the community is mad at you. They're saying, we're in this together, and we recognize we've just found ourselves in a precarious situation. And by calling it for what it is, people, I think, get a sense of assurance. I mean, I know this is true in business and in leadership. If a CEO comes in and lies about the financial situation, the employees aren't assured, and they start to panic more. But if a CEO comes in and says, we've got some serious hurdles to overcome, but there's a plan, and we're going to get through this, that is the kind of leadership that's inspiring. And that's the kind of leadership that a pastor brings to a congregation, in the sense that the pastor is able to say, don't worry, everybody, I know there's zombies out there. In this case, they're metaphorical zombies, you know. I know that you're infected, and it's hard. You struggle against yourself. Sin, death, and the devil, but also just our stupid self-interest. And by identifying it, but saying that there is a remedy, this is the thing that leads us forward.
I wonder if you've thought at all, and even in your conversations with Professor Brighton, that, you know, Ecclesiastes is such a strong book because, you know, it says, under the sun, S-U-N, There's nothing worth really living for. We are like zombies, you know. Everything is meaningless vanity. It goes on. And this is a guy that had the tools and the means and the time to try everything, you know. And he comes up short. He just said, hey, it's not worth it. And but then he, you know, there's rare glimpses in there of, hey, but life under the sun, S-O-N, is really worth it. And so when we go there, Jeff, we want to take a little time here to talk about these three circumstances that you mentioned to us that do help, like life-threatening situations where, you know, we want to know, okay, under this condition, what are the percentages for successful overcoming of this disease? For example, cancer would be. It gets people's attention, and you know, so much commonality in this. My goodness, you know, you watch any of the baseball playoffs, there's pink all over. for people that have been in this breast cancer scenario together. And so those are great times for us to bring out the big guns, right? We're all in this. We're all going to die of something, cancer, so be it. But we've got a big player in the ballpark who has taken on all of this and, knocked it out of the park for us.
Yeah, and you know, lest we think that there's a simple formula, right? It would be a bad idea for someone to say, I don't know anything about zombies, but I got to go talk to the high school kids this week. So, you know, I'm just going to use that. I know it'll work. It might or it might not.
Yeah.
You don't know.
Yeah.
One of my other colleagues, Scott Keith, who's also a member of the 1517 crew that's doing some blogging, he is just, I think, stumbled on a couple very important ways of thinking about this with relation to young people. And that is, Scott Keith says, he talks about a functional epistemology. So the first thing he does with students is says, is there a way for me to understand how you'd make decisions about what's true or false? Because they do have them, right? They know what's a good movie and a bad movie, or what's a good video game and a bad video game. They go to resources that tell them, and they have rankings, and they have reviews, and so they treat certain areas of their life with a sense of intellectual rigor, right? They're critical thinkers when it comes to which video games they'll purchase, but they also have their own questions. So I think too often apologetics has, for good reason, you know, you want it to be memorizable or something that you can do. But I think too many people think that apologetics is only for professional philosophers and theologians who are going to come up with a formula such that they could memorize the formula, show up and talk to any individual, and then they'll win.
One size works for all, right?
Yeah. And I think, you know, the real moral of the story isn't to just go to the zombie genre, although I think it really has some legs. The first step is to ask questions and really listen. What are they concerned about? And what are the ways in which they're talking about sin, death, and the devil, but they're using vocabulary that maybe is not recognizable to the older person who's trying to communicate it? Likewise, if we don't understand the language that they're using to talk about their frustrations and struggles, then we must recognize that we're probably not speaking the language that they need to hear, using the terms that they need to hear. And so really listening before we speak in apologetics is essential.
Absolutely. And I think that's such a strong admonition for all of us that I think I would be exposed so quickly on this zombie thing by the kids asking me some questions in return. And I'm like, I'd have to admit, I'm not really into this. I just thought it'd be a good ploy to talk to you on this theological level. And you're saying far better to inquire, if you can, about personal places that they're at in their life and relate to them on that. And that's so important, as we know, in talking with anybody, is, you know, not trying to win the debate, the apologetic debate, or make more points, or to argue more effectively. Find out where they are, and then introduce them to Jesus, as our good friend Dallister McGrath says. And so, Jeff, we're unfortunately running out of time. I think give some more thought, you and your colleagues, to the zombie approach, and do some work on it. And let's maybe we could even have a round table discussion with even some young people, and help the rest of us that aren't around them that much talk about it. So thanks for being our guest today, and we look forward to more in this series that you did with 1517, the Legacy Project. What's wrong with apologetics? Continue to be there with our young people, Jeff. And we so appreciate it. And richest blessings, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you. You too. Be well.